This interview was recorded for the International Bomber Command Centre Digital Archive, which owns the copyright for this performance.
This interview has been conducted for the International Bomber Command Centre. The interviewer is Hugh Donnelly, and the interviewee is Bill Warwick. The interview is taking place at Mr. Warwick's home at Gainsborough on the 27th of February 2018. On the 13th of March 2018.
I was 5 years old when Britain declared war with Germany in September 1939 and lived on a farm in North Lincolnshire within striking distance of a dozen airfields, the nearest being Curtin Lindsay, home of the American Eagle Squadron. Scampton, the Dam Busters with Guy Gibson, Ibblestow, famous for Margaret Horton and her ride on the Spitfire tail, Blighton with the Polish pilots, Santoft and Sturgate. So there was plenty of air activity. This formed the early part of my life. Also, within 250 yards was an anti-aircraft unit, together with searchlights, machine guns and posts, etc. This was a target for the German bombers, mainly Dorniers. And they tried to demolish the camp by dropping incendiaries, but luckily they missed the camp by a few yards. Most of the bombs were dug out by hand and defused, and one stood at the back door of the farmhouse for years as a memento. When the army lads first arrived, they were billeted in farm buildings attached to our cottage. My mother baked pies for them, and in return they felled birch trees from the local woods to keep the kitchen fire going. The soldiers also came round in the morning to shave with the hot water. Mugs of water balanced at every point convenient. Vivid memories of the Dorniers in the searchlights shining silver and trying to dodge the beam. Also in quiet moments the soldiers would shine the beam at us when we stood watching from the back door of our house. When I started school, the first instruction was to take cover under the desks when I had to do so by the teacher. This was done when an aircraft passed overhead, whether it was friend or foe. Bert Carpenter, the headmaster, was a member of the Royal Observer Corps, but I wasn't aware of that until much later in my life. The next thing of note was one morning I went out to feed the chickens and the sound of machine guns blazing away greeted me. My mother dashed out shouting, come in, the Germans are here. This proved to be a barrage balloon had broken its moorings at either Hull or Grimsby and the Spitfires from Curtin Lindsay were trying to puncture the balloon so that it would sink to the ground. I have no idea how much shooting was carried out, but when I came home from school, the balloon was virtually down at Middlemore Farm near Susworth, about a mile away, where it had either snagged on a farm implement or had been tied to one. During the war years, double summertime was in operation to give the farmers better daylight working hours. As young lads, this was to benefit to the three of us young lads to play cricket until dusk. This we did with an old oil drum for wickets, a piece of a five-barred gate for a bat, and a wooden ball from a coconut stall. This carried on until one of the lads bowling missed a catch and it struck his eye, splitting it wide open. Whereupon we held him under the pump to treat the problem. Later we acquired a rubber ball. Because we were out at dusk, the Lancasters mainly assembled to the north of us, somewhere in the River Humber region, to fly south and probably the Isle of Wight before dispersing over Germany to their allotted targets. The sight of the engine exhaust glowing in the gathering gloom is another outstanding memory, and later in life I was to trace the history of some of the aircrew for a friend who had lost track of a long gone uncles, etc. Doodlebugs on V1s were another intrusion. Mostly they were launched from France, to the south of England, but when the RAF destroyed the launching positions in France, they sent them over to attack Manchester and Sheffield from Holland. One night, we heard these V1s with a motorbike noise, and my dad had got out of bed to see what was happening. I said, get back to bed, there are only mosquitoes coming home. But he says, I've got a fire at the back. I heard one that crashed onto a pigsty. Otherwise, I don't know much about them in North Lincolnshire. Because of our proximity to the airfields, quite a lot of aircraft crashed in the area. And because I didn't have a bike, I had only heard about them. Most were under guard anyway until the RAF rescue vehicles took the remains away, both human and material. Many aircraft around us were Spitfires, Hurricanes, Lancasters, Halifax, Lysanders, Lockheed Lightnings from Goxhill, Whitleys, Wellingtons, Ansons and later Venoms, Vampires and Meteors. I can't remember many German aircraft coming over, only Junkers and Dorniers really. There wasn't any time like street, there wasn't anything like street lights or other lighting because it was complete blackout. Car lights were restricted to 4 candle power to shine no more than 10 feet in front of the car with a hood to deflect the light. Even a cycle lamp had to be hooded to shine onto the front wheel. We must mention the Royal Observer Corps, without who played a major part in the outcome of the war. Their volunteer observers provided 24-hour cover 7 days a week, stood out in the open in all weathers, looking and listening under the supervision of Fighter Command. They identified friend or foe.
Recording briefly stopped and now started again.
They were identified friend or foe across the British Isles for their work during the early war years in 1940, and they were granted the title Royal. So I don't know how that will finish off. That's the end of it.
That's great. That's the end of the recording. Thank you very much.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you.
Good. So is it when you're ready?
Right. Bill is going to continue this with a short history of the Royal Observer Corps.
And this is the foreword from... I'll just stop it a minute. Right. This is the foreword from Attack Warning Red, and it was a book written by Derek Wood about the formation and the history of the Royal Observer Corps. So, describing the early history of the Royal Observer Corps, Derek Wood made the point in this book that the Corps did not fit neatly into service or ministry. In a sense, that was true. From the outset, the Corps fostered a strong volunteer spirit coupled with a healthy egalitarianism, which led in turn to resistance among its members to the concept of a paid service because it was voluntary. This total commitment to volunteer ethics set the Royal Observer Corps apart from the formal organisation of peacetime services. Yet, once it came under the wing of the Air Ministry in 1929, the community of interest was soon recognised and there sprang up a close and harmonious relationship with the Royal Air Force, which continues until this day. In fact, the Royal Air Force Association have now took over the running, basically, of the Royal Observer Corps. Under a series of wise leaders, the Royal Observer Corps expanded during the 1930s along with the Royal Air Force. It was all done on a shoestring, and it is revealing now to learn that the 16-scoop structure decided in 1935 was to cost no more than £10,000 per year. Never before, and I suspect never again, could a nation obtain a vital arm of defence so cheaply. But it was when Lord Dowding took over Fighter Command that the Royal Observer Corps really achieved its highest purpose. Fully aware of the limitation of the primitive radars available to him, he had a clear understanding of the Corps' worth as a complement to them and of the vital role it would play in the struggle that lay ahead. Where others were dazzled by the promise of new technology, he stoutly defended the requirement for visual and audio tracking of enemy aircraft. When Winston Churchill dismissed the techniques of the Royal Observatory as Stone Age, Dowding sprang to its defence, and of course he was right. Derek Wood recounts fully and entertainingly in this book of the Royal Observatory in the Second World War, and what a magnificent story it is. During the Battle of Britain and afterwards, the Royal Observatory provided our only intelligence on aircraft operating below 500 feet. And because its members were well trained and as keen as mustard, the Corps were not confined to low-level reporting. The operation of the alarm within the alert, notification of bailouts and crashes, and a wealth of other intelligence flowed from the Observatory posts. As the war ground on, the Royal Observatory expanded in every direction, helping home lame ducks, assisting in air sea rescue, and taking an heroic part in D-Day fleet, with its members dressed in hybrid uniforms as temporary naval petty officers. The list of its activities is endless. It was all made possible by the ideal of selflessness, freely given, volunteer service, and a tap warning red provides us with a timely reminder of the worth and strength of that ideal. After the war came the anticlimax of stand down from 45 to 47. But Fighter Command expanded at the time of the Korean War. The Royal Observatory once again came to its assistance. Valiant efforts were made to regain lost ground, but although it remained effective throughout the 1950s in identifying and plotting low-level raids, the advent of high-speed, high-flying jets could neither be seen nor heard was to prove an insuperable problem. Thus, it was the role of the Corps changed in the early 1960s to that of monitoring nuclear fallout. As the field force of the UK monitoring and warning organisation, the Royal Observatory continued to play a vital role in defence of this country and still maintains the close contact with the RAF, which has become so much part of its history. To all those who have served in the Royal Observatory or have ever been associated with it, this book will be a joy to read. I count a great honour to have been asked to contribute this foreword, and I take this opportunity on behalf of the Royal Air Force to salute the Royal Observatory and all its members, past and present. And that was Air Chief Marshal Sir Andrew Humphrey, Chief of the Air Staff. Will that do?
Thank you, Bill. That's lovely. And that concludes the recording.
Yes.
Thank you very much.